Well, thanks, Marty. I want to thank KITP for having us. This is a very broad program and not easy to manage. So I want to thank Marty in particular for all the help with that. So my talk will attempt to focus on what we're doing in the program, ongoing and new directions. But I certainly want to give the background, and therefore there will be a certain amount of review. So that it'll be roughly two parts. The most of it will be the first part. The news in this subject is to do with the data release from Planck, and not just that, but a number of other experiments have been very important in this field. And so we want to focus on what's new there, what the implications are for theory, and new directions, ongoing work in that direction. But the subject is also highly motivated by the situation we're in theoretically, where there are questions that we're extremely confused about. So the overall framework for cosmology, if you really take it seriously from start to finish, is unknown. And I want to give you a flavor of that and what we're doing about it also by the end, if we have time. So the goal of the first part will be to make these pictures clear, and also make it such that you understand the following joke. So this leads to Planck suppressed operators. And by the end of the talk, I hope you understand exactly what is meant by that. So the first plot here is the logo for our program. It has to do with the two-point correlation functions of the primordial perturbations in the universe, the scalar perturbations, zeta, and tensor perturbations of the metric commonly called gamma, and I'll be explaining enough about it to make this plot clear. And next we'll consider the higher point correlation functions of these primordial seeds, where there are also important results. I want to emphasize that this Planck data release and other experiments have done a lot with other topics that are really important, and a lot of the discussion has been about them. New measurements of cosmological parameters, and lensing of the material that's in the way of the CMB coming toward us has been a big deal in the data release and in the program. I won't talk about it because there are experts on that have done so beautifully, so I recommend those online talks in particular. I will talk a little bit about so-called anomalies quoted by the Planck collaboration. And there's been a lot of discussion of consistency of the data between different experiments and within Planck itself, which is not very important, of course, but not something I'm an expert on, so I won't cover it. And also there's been a lot of discussion about the prospects for using sort of non-CMB measurements of large-scale structure to get further information about various quantities of interest, and again, that's important, but I won't actually cover it here in the talk, but I just want to mention it. Okay, so the implications of this data that I want to discuss are basically all in the context of the leading theory of primordial cosmology, which is inflation. So I want to give you, to begin with, a brief lightning review of that topic. So the idea, of course, is that the universe is expanding and has a scale factor A of t that describes how it expands. One of the Einstein equations describes that most directly. Where here M sub p is the Planck mass scale, about 10 to the 19 or 10 to the 18 GeV, depending on how you normalize it with pi's. And Hubble is A dot over A. And the idea of inflation is that there is, or was, accelerated expansion in the early universe to solve the horizon problem, the flatness problem, and so on. So now if you take this equation and you imagine that the right-hand side is approximately constant, So in other words, if the time derivatives of Hubble are sufficiently small, then the solution of this equation is approximately exponential expansion, giving us this inflation. And there are, so basically, two ways, qualitatively speaking, basically two ways of accomplishing this. So this pertains, in particular, if the potential energy dominates over the kinetic energy. And there are basically two ways of doing this. One way, which is known as slow roll inflation, which is the classic way, is to simply imagine that the potential energy, so here I have in mind a scalar field, I should have said. Although that may not be quote unquote fundamental, but it's certainly the simplest model to think about. Again, let me back up. The Einstein equations describe the expansion of the universe in response to matter sources. Let's suppose there's a scalar field whose potential and kinetic energy plays that role in the early universe. Then to get inflation, to get accelerated expansion, one wants Hubble here not to change very fast. And so one wants the kinetic energy to be much smaller than the potential energy over a sufficiently long period. So one way to do that is to just have the potential energy V of phi be approximately constant because it's very flat. And a second way is to have instead a steep potential, but have self-interactions that ensure that the field rolls slowly. So I'll just draw that like this. There are UV complete examples of this second case known as well. So this is macroscopically what inflation looks like. And the big bonus that's relevant for these results is that once we postulate this theory, modeling it with this dynamical scalar field, we have to take into account its fluctuations. So this field changes with time in a slow way to produce this effect, but it has quantum mechanical fluctuations. And this fact leads to seeds for structure as an automatic consequence of this theory. This is a huge bonus that leads to observations, and so let me take a couple of minutes to review that. So let me just do it with a picture. So one has this environment of an accelerated expansion of the universe with a scalar field around, and let's look at a patch of the universe which is of order its characteristic size, the inverse of Hubble at the time. So there's this accelerated expansion going on. There are modes of the scalar field, delta phi, which well inside this Hubble patch are oscillating very wildly, very, very rapidly, like they are in Minkowski space. So they live basically in the Minkowski vacuum, and they have the usual Minkowski vacuum fluctuations. But as time goes on, these modes stretch out, and they freeze out at a scale in this first case of slow roll inflation at a length scale of order inverse Hubble. And further evolution of the universe proceeds with, in the simplest case, this frozen out mode surviving until inflation ends in a way dictated by this potential energy dying away, at which point these fluctuations come back into our observable patch and seed structure. So this is parameterized in a nice way in terms of the metric of baseline, including fluctuations now. So this was the homogeneous metric. But if we allow for fluctuations, it's natural to write it more generally. So one can package this in terms of the spatial components of the metric, where we have the overall homogeneous expansion A of t times a scalar zeta and also tensor perturbations gamma. So there's a time reparameterization symmetry which allows us to gauge away one scalar degree of freedom in the problem. That could be, depending on your choice of gauge, phi itself or zeta, so it's kind of useful, as usual in gauge theories, to go between different gauges where you either put it here or you put it here, and I'll say more about that as we go. Putting it here, which is a nice thing to do for purposes of understanding the evolution outside the horizon throughout the exit period and so on, one obtains, again, just for simplicity, talking now about the slow roll case, results for the two-point correlation function of these perturbations, which I'm not going to put the pi's in, even though they're important. Scales like this. So that's the scalar perturbation and the tensor perturbation. Scales with Hubble itself. Stop me if there are any questions, of course. Okay. So these calculations are easy to do within the context of the model that I just gave, and as we'll see, in a more model independent way as well. And here we see actually the two parameters that we're going to be interested in for understanding the results I quoted over there. One of them is right here, the so-called tilt of the spectrum. In a situation where these inequalities are satisfied, the freeze out of the modes happens almost at the same scale for all of them. But since there is a need to exit from this phase to ordinary cosmology at later times, there is some H dot is not zero, and as a result of that, the fluctuations are expected to be not quite scale invariant, but to deviate from that. So the tilt of the spectrum, as now constrained by the results of, for example, the Planck release, lie here on this horizontal axis, and one of the big results there is, in fact, that the tilt is bounded away from one at five and a half sigma. So one of the big results of Planck is that the tilt is in fact not one at good significance, 5.4 sigma.
So I remember that, at least for WMAP, there was a statement that if you had a really funny sort of reionization, in principle you could actually still get away with like an NS of one. So I guess that's not an Saturnian locker in this instance, or is that not?
They certainly are, you know, deal with that issue, and I'm not going to. You can look in the papers for how they treated that, this is their claim.
I can't read the power of k.
I'm sorry. Okay, the power of k here is 3. Which just in position space just corresponds to a logarithmic two-point function, plus an offset. So if this parameter ns were 1, it would just be n sub s. Yes, sorry. You can't read my right. It's the same thing as here. So this is just a measure of how not scale invariant it is. It's close to 1, but it's not quite 1. Okay, so this is the main thing to say on first pass about scalar perturbations. Now, the tensor perturbations are extremely interesting, and I want to take time with them as well. What the vertical axis is over here is the ratio of these two things, the tensor to scalar. And the bounds on this, which are basically what I've drawn here, are the 2 sigma 95% contours. The bounds on R are indirect at this point. It has to do with bounds on the total power to which the gravity waves would contribute. But there are experiments that are dedicated to looking for the CMB imprint of gravity waves much more directly, which will directly measure this or constrain it.
Stupid question. So you said that this theta, or
yes,
whatever you call it,
yes,
in some sense it's a choice of gauge whether you put it there or not. So obviously,
yes, yes,
this correlation function is probably not directly measurable.
Yeah, I mean,
obviously, NS is an observable, and R probably also is an observable.
Yeah, it's more fair to say what's directly observed, or closer to directly observed, is the grade of, is the Laplacian of this guy, which is why it's sometimes called the curvature perturbation, which feeds into the complicated Boltzmann equation, you know, interacting with the fluid during recombination. Sorry, is this what you're asking?
So basically, this correlator is measurable in some sense?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't gone through the transfer of this primordial initial condition through all the evolution of the exit and reheating, et cetera, to the time recombination when the CMB is produced. All of that is understood. And I mean, depends what you mean by direct, but yes, this is observable. How do you say again?
How do people measure this R?
Yeah, okay, so this is a neat story. So the CMB comes to us from recombination, right, which is when the atoms form. There's a plasma around then, and in the presence of a gravitational wave, the scattering of the CMB photons off the electrons gets polarized in a particular pattern, known as a B-mode pattern, and that's how they look for this directly. So this is what's called B-mode polarization. Planck has not released any polarization yet. And this particular quantity is thought to be at least as well, if not better, done using more dedicated methods. And happily, there's a suite of experiments planning to do this in the next few years. So it's a great story. In fact, I was going to get to this next. But are there any other questions?
You want to remark about the shine?
This is being very naive. This is the way it would go. The H is decreasing. This is the way it would go. But it's true, you can make models of inflation that do a lot of different things. So I deliberately didn't quote it as a strict test of inflation.
Do you want to say a word about how you go from the observations to getting N?
To getting this N, or
yeah.
How do you go from the observations to getting N? I mean, you have a power spectrum, which is a function of momentum, basically, and it has all this physics of acoustic peaks from the plasma during recombination. And basically, you have to understand all that physics and how that gives you L dependence, and subtract that out and look at how this thing behaves as a function of L. So they're doing that. I don't want to comment much on the data analysis involved in these things because I'm not the expert on that. We had a fantastic conference and program generally, which included, you know, the collaboration came out in force and explained a lot about what they did. So, this is the very basic idea. So keep asking questions. If I'll just keep saying I don't know when it comes to things like that. Okay, so wanted to highlight this, which is a major milestone. And now I just want to express enthusiasm for the whole thing. So these fluctuations are a probe of two things, really, two highly related things. For one, it's a probe of what's going on, what the quantum field theory that's involved, that's around in the early universe, highly time-dependent, and also, for reasons that I'll get to momentarily, particularly involving this axis, but also more generally, it's even sensitive to certain quantum gravity corrections. In a very standard way. One of the recent developments in the field has been, in particular, a more systematic so-called effective field theory formulation of the field theory of the perturbations. So I want to comment on that. And as far, again, as quantum gravity goes, the tensor to scalar ratio is the place to especially look. And I want to also comment, one of the nice things about this field has been a very strong interplay between these two sides of the community. Certain top-down inflationary mechanisms made people realize that one needed to broaden our understanding of what inflationary perturbations could be. And that's been done in a beautiful way in this effective theory, to the extent that you can just throw out the original motivation if you prefer to. Let me continue, though, with the two-point function before moving to that and discuss R, which has already gotten some questions. Okay, so R is basically this tensor to scalar ratio. So why do I say that it's sensitive to quantum gravity? Well, there are basically two reasons for that. The first is just kind of in front of us. We're talking about the variance of the quantum mechanical variance of a metric perturbation. In other words, the quantum mechanical zero-point energy of the metric. But from a model-building point of view, I have something else in mind, which is that turns out that at the level R can be observed in this regime where this parameter is bigger than a percent or so, there's infinite what's called UV sensitivity from the model building point of view. And for this, this is one of those nice things that I can just do in two lines. So this is a result due to Lyth, which goes as follows. So let's ask how the number of E-foldings of inflation, by which we mean the log of the ratio of A of the scale factor at the end to the start of the process, goes with the quantities in our problem. So just this number of E-foldings is really integrated, this integral of dA over A, which we can write as V dot over A dt. So this is just Hubble. And let's express it now in terms of the field. Again, assuming a standard scalar field, which we can do just in this obvious way. And now let me just repackage that slightly by pulling out, multiplying and dividing by 2 powers of the Planck mass. And now let's make an assumption that this factor is approximately constant. One can deviate from that and get corresponding small changes to the following result, but it's morally true. And if you take it out, then what you get is that you get a relation between the field range delta phi and in Planck units and the tensor to scalar ratio, because what sits here, I think I erased it, I had it down here, zeta goes like h squared over phi dot, and the tensor perturbation just goes like Hubble over at Planck, so this is the square root of the tensor to scalar ratio here. So this relationship is wonderful, it's really convenient. If you put in the numbers, what you find is in fact a R of order 0.01 corresponds to a Planck range of field. So if these B-mode experimentalists get to where they really think they will, which is this scale, then they will be crossing this threshold of a Planck range in field. And that is very significant from this model building point of view for the hopefully clear reason that if you look at your potential and you had structure in it controlled by this ratio of phi over m Planck, as you would if you just take a effective field theory point of view with the idea that there's some degrees of freedom up the Planck scale and write down arbitrary contributions to the effective action suppressed by that scale. If you go over a Planck range in field space, you're sensitive to an infinite number of those corrections. Now, what we really do with that is use symmetries to control it. Things like the shift symmetries you get from axions. And one of the fun things is that axions in string theory behave quite differently from the sort of traditional axions in field theory in giving such a large field range. But the general point that I should emphasize is simply the UV sensitivity of the whole thing and the accessibility of these measurements to this threshold. So I should say also, because it's important and maybe something everybody's heard of as well, is that even for small field inflation, one is sensitive to Planck suppressed operators, the dimension 6 Planck suppressed operators change the slow roll parameters by order 1. So one is sensitive at leading order to Planck suppressed operators, even for small field inflation. But what it requires is a sort of 1% tune in that case. Okay, so for now, that's what I will say about the two-point functions. And now I want to go on to discuss the higher point correlation functions in the same spirit. Are there any more questions?
So what do you assume about the number of foldings here?
So if you're up at the gut scale, it's 60, and then it's lower if you assume that you start inflation at a lower scale. So, yeah.
Can you say a little bit more about how the data has already or can distinguish between the slow roll and...
We're getting there. That's the next one. Yeah.
Cool.
It hasn't actually done that yet, despite initial reactions.
What do you mean when you say 1% to...
What I mean is, on the one hand, I'm making a big deal of this sensitivity of Planck suppressed operators, but on the other hand, I'm just saying you just need the coefficient to have a 1% accidental, smallness of order of percent. So that's, in contrast to, for these large field examples, we consider something that's basically a generalization of the very first model of inflation, m squared phi squared, which is radiatively stable, controlled by an approximate shift symmetry. So in this case, there's really not a tune. And I'm not sure somebody might keep me honest about this from the program, but I'm not sure there's a similar symmetry protection in known examples of small field inflation. But perhaps there could be. Okay. So, okay, so I'll say a little bit more about the sort of substructure on this plot later, but let's go on to these quantities, which is known as the non-Gaussianity, for obvious reasons, that it's the to do with the higher point correlation functions of these perturbations. So once again, from the UV point of view, from the point of view of models of inflation, this comes about if you have a steep potential with self-interactions that keep it slow. Self-interactions are dissipation that keep it slow. And you might like to know, as Risa just asked, whether one could distinguish that possibility from flat potentials as the source of, as the mechanism behind inflation. And not surprisingly, in this case, where some self-interactions are keeping the field slow and the potential varying slowly, the results are more non-Gaussian than otherwise. But, you know, UV models are sort of particular, and there's no real reason a priori to pick one over another. So there's been a movement in the field to instead, and this turns out to be quite useful, particularly for studying non-Gaussianity, to focus on simply on the physics of the perturbations. And this has become known as the effective field theory of inflation. And let me just give you a flavor for that. So it's kind of to be compared to, let's say, spontaneous symmetry breaking for a U1 gauge field. Let me just start with that. So there, it's natural to consider a field like this pion field, which makes manifest the gauge symmetry transforming nonlinearly under it as a mu goes to a mu plus b mu lambda. And this would-be Goldstone boson is a good description of the physics at scales above the scale m at which it mixes with the gauge fields. So what one does in this inflationary version of that is first gauge away the scalar field, as I mentioned earlier, could be done. Let's just gauge away delta phi, choose time slices such that delta phi is zero. And so we put it all in the metric. And that gives us a Lagrangian that one could write generally respecting the symmetries, which depends on things like the upper 0,0 component of the metric. Think of this as being able to be contracted with phi dot squared. So there's a spontaneous breaking of the time translation symmetry in this inflationary background. But then it's nice to add back in this pion-like field instead. And let me write that over here. So to do that, one simply basically undoes this reparametrization and puts in the field pi, which transforms nonlinearly under the diffeomorphism, redefining time. And again, this is rather analogous to this gauge theory case, where in appropriate ranges of scales, one can focus on the physics of the Goldstone mode. It decouples from the gauge field, in this case, the metric. So you implement that here. And we're talking, I'm going to erase this because it's taking up a lot of room. So you implement that, you get an effective action for this pion-like field. And I'll just write a couple terms of it. So I want to write the kinetic terms and then a characteristic interaction term. Like this. And you can do this. I hope you can imagine how you might do this. And then you can, so again, this is a theory expanded around some presumed inflationary background, but otherwise making no assumption, single field, but no other assumption. As long as you keep the dot, dot, dots here, you've made no other assumption. It gives a very nice way of seeing what parameters go into the possible non-Gaussian correlation functions. Now, I haven't written everything down. There are a number of parameters that come in, but what I've written is enough to show you a little of the flavor of it. So from this alone, you could just ask, how big are the non-Gaussian corrections going to be? So you can ask about the ratio of the cubic to quadratic Lagrangian, for example, at the place where the modes freeze out, which in the context of these theories, there's an interesting little subtlety about, which I should mention now. So I wrote the kinetic term here. There's a sound speed, C sub s, that appears in it, which is a parameter that's available that's completely consistent with the symmetries. And of course, it's something less than or equal to 1. You can basically see from this term that whereas in slow roll inflation, you're used to the perturbations freezing out at the horizon, here they freeze out at the sound horizon. So at the freeze out is not actually at Hubble in terms of momentum, but at Hubble over the sound speed. So you put that in. Find an interesting result that the effective sound speed of these perturbations directly controls a level of non-Gaussianity. The zeta, again, is the scalar perturbation. So we can come back to Reese's question. Can we now take this and ask how close, is there a threshold for non-Gaussianity that we should aim for?
I should think of the pi theory as it goes on in the time-like direction.
Yeah, so the gauge symmetry is...
How does it get a right sine kinetic term?
How does it get a right sine kinetic term? Why would it not get a...
Because it's in the time-like direction.
It's not the conformal factor. It's
for the gauge theory, it's a spatial component that gets a ghost on. But here you're saying that it's a time-like direction it's a time-like big direction that gets a ghost on. So I would have thought it's in the time direction, if I understand.
That's not what you get, but let's talk about it afterwards.
So I understand. So when you say gauge symmetry, you're talking about the diffeomorphic symmetry, not the gauge symmetry of the zero that you're writing down.
This was for analogy, this was for the dark matter in LHC. Well, and anybody else, condensed matter, people who might know more about that. So is there a threshold for non-Gaussianity? Well, I think certainly the slow roll is just infinitely Gaussian. down to, you know, interactions involving gravity that we're neglecting here. So there's not really a threshold you get to show that you're at slow roll, but there's a point that has been nicely made in the subject about another fiducial scale you might consider and compare to. So we have this field pi, which is analogous to, which is a Goldstone mode. And so you can do the usual manipulations to generate the corresponding scale f pi for it. And if you had a theory sort of like QCD where that was the only scale in the problem, then, well, that would be a scale to think about. And you could ask how these results compare to that. By the way, actually, let me back up and say that at this level we just discussed, the bounds on the sound speed, which is the thing related to the model parameters in any realization of this idea, the bounds on this are roughly that it has to be bigger than 0.01 or something. So from this point of view, you already see that it's not very close to 1, which is the slow roll result. Okay, but let me just finish with a slightly more sophisticated way of looking at things. So so the scale of time dependence is tiny. The scale of freeze-out, which is where we work, is Hubble as an energy scale. And you could ask about these higher point correlation functions, canonically normalizing them as you know, is natural. So let's say you do that and call it pi sub c. So we want to ask about this suppression scale lambda and where it sits here. And this has been analyzed, and one finds that it's below this fiducial scale of f pi, you know, by a factor of 10 or something. I'm being rather rough here, but that's partly because people debate factors of pi, as in 3.14159, in assessing this. But basically, this is the picture. So the one could still hit this scale of interactions mattering before you even get to this sort of single scale fiducial f pi range. Okay, so that's, I should say, one of the, or two, I should say, of the FNL constraints, the so-called equilateral and also orthogonal, pertain to this physics. The other one, which actually came out as a much stronger bound, is known as FNL local. And that was the one that was like within 5 of being 0. And it can be used very nicely, I think, as a precision limit on additional sectors of fields. So far, for simplicity, I focused on single fields being involved, a single inflaton field being involved, or a single clock, as it's often described. But it's perfectly possible for additional fields to be involved in the process, interacting with the inflaton. And if they're light enough in some appropriate sense, then this other non-Gaussianity parameter that I listed would turn on. Since they got a very nice improvement on the constraints of that, you can turn it around and you can ask whether there could be couplings of your inflaton to other sectors of fields. Let's just label that with some operator O and ask, you know, how big this scale is forced to be, and you find nice constraints where their result excludes direct couplings between inflation and other sectors through higher dimension operators, you know, down to a scale several orders of magnitude above Hubble. So that's a nice bound. Okay. I want to say now something about a similar question about heavier fields, because it's one of my favorite directions that things could improve even back at the level of the two-point functions, unless there are questions about the overview of the non-Gaussianity. So yeah.
Is it generic or is it surprising that there are no additional light fields?
That's a matter of taste. So there's Occam's razor, and Matthias tells me there's something else called Hickam's principle, which was in medicine, where it was the patient can have as many diseases as he damn well pleases. So before the data came out, we were having these discussions of Occam versus Hickam, and I don't know. So I would like to take the... again, maybe some of the people who worked further on this could comment, but I would like to take this and ask whether these elaborate string theory models we all like, where there's a bunch of different warped sectors, et cetera, are, yeah, how they survive against this, for example.
Well, because there has to be eventually reheating, you do have some motivation for eventually there being light degrees of freedom.
Certainly, eventually, yeah. We know that.
So now this puts a bound on how that turns out, in principle.
In principle, yeah. But there are lots of nuances. I mean, you can have, and it's not very strange, really, to have couplings of inflaton to other sectors, such that these other things get light temporarily during inflation, then get heavy again. This says nothing about that. So there's a huge space available still. So let me say something that I think is, I personally think is quite interesting, even though it's really trivial, which is how actually additional heavy fields matter. And these are the kind of things we expect in the UV completion string theory, is full of heavy fields at different scales. But let me just say a quick thing about a toy model of that. Suppose I have two fields, a heavy field, phi sub h, which wants to sit at a value m here, and couple it to our candidate inflaton field. Phi sub l, so this is the candidate inflaton. Now, if phi heavy sat at, let's say this mass is large, larger than the Hubble scale we're going to consider. So if you just put phi heavy at that mass scale m, you would get m squared phi squared inflation for this light field. However, you can solve the equations, it's trivial algebra here, and instead what you find is that this potential at large field values completely flattens out, and the reason for that is that instead the system adjusts to a more energetically favorable configuration where that happens. And in this silly toy model, it does so to an infinite extent. It's as if you start with m squared phi squared, and then you ended up way down here. And again, this mass is parametrically heavier than the Hubble in this example. So I drew this curve for string theory axions, and they basically behave like this. They have couplings which look, so I'm just going to write something down without maybe having time to really explain too much, but I'll try. So one has axions that come from higher dimensional analogs of potential fields. Sorry. This is the potential for the inflaton phi sub light at phi sub heavy solved for its equations of motion, which turns out to be a good approximation, including the kinetic terms. Sorry. I rushed through this because I've been a complete broken record on it for those in our program, but to me, this is a beautiful opportunity to, you know, for further data to come in and either hone in on M squared, phi squared, which is the simplest model of inflation, or push away from it, which has started to happen. And this, I would say, would be the generic expectation in any UV completion to have at least heavy fields that couple to the inflaton and adjust. So, long story short, for string theory axions, they behave that way. So they have a structure which I'll just draw it, which has various branches, which each of which flattens out. So each branch behaves like some fiducial potential V of phi. That's often some power law with t less than 2 because of this effect I just mentioned, plus some sinusoidal modulation on top of that, which can also be looked for in the power spectrum and the non-Gaussianity. The results from string theory on this type of model really just, I think, can be understood in this simple way as at least this flattening part of it from the adjustments of heavy fields such as the flux fields and the metric and so on. So I won't go further on about that, but it's one of the analyzing for these oscillations is an interesting direction that's ongoing. Okay, so let me say a couple things about other aspects of the data that people have been talking about, which include these anomalies, so-called, reported by the Planck release, although WMAP's all the same and didn't interpret them as optimistically as anomalies. So one of them is that there's low power relative to the so-called lambda CDM parameterization at low L, so at L less than, I think, 40, or maybe around 40, you hit cosmic variance at some point. There's possibly a so-called power asymmetry, meaning that sort of on two sides of the universe, these the result for this scalar perturbation zeta that I was talking about is a little bit different on the two sides of the universe. Again, not at a large statistical significance. But it's an interesting possibility, which they emphasized in the release. So one of the fun things we've had at the program is the experts on this, both within the collaboration, doing it in different ways. So what this boils, one thing this boils down to is a four-point function. It's a correlation of, you know, zeta zeta here and here, and so-called tau and L is constrained. So at high values of L, it's in the process of being sorted out whether this asymmetry exists. At lower values of L, one is, I guess, limited by cosmic variance, but one sees an effect both in WMAP and Planck. So people are looking at this in interesting ways. One can have situations with more than one field that account for it by having basically different trajectories for the field on the left and right side of this picture, on two sides of our patch of the universe. And another very interesting approach is known as, with additional fields, involves the fact that people asked a little bit earlier about the evolution of these modes outside the horizon during the complicated physics of exit reheating and so on. Turns out with more than one field, the perturbation does not remain, this zeta does not remain constant and can get infected with contributions from these epochs. And one interesting direction people are pursuing is to take into account the fact that in reheating one needs to excite other degrees of freedom anyway. It's a natural thing to expect. And the physics of reheating, of the field exiting from inflation, exciting other degrees of freedom and interacting with them, can get quite nonlinear and violent and then have an imprint on zeta, which could lead to anomalies like this. So there's interesting work going on that. And then also, you know, various non-Gaussian shapes are kind of hanging around at a small sigma level, same order as this, including a what they refer to as an oscillatory feature in the maps. Finally, as far as low sigma things go, my favorite is this fact that this m squared phi squared model is 2 sigma disfavored relative to a bunch of other things, including these more flat potentials, but also including the original model of inflation, the Starobinsky model. So, you can take that for what it's worth. And actually, it's interesting to ask if this original model of inflation has a UV completion that's well motivated. Okay, I was going to get to this other side of the subject, but we're out of time, so I'll just make a couple of comments about it. Are there questions, though, about the first part? Okay. People look a little puzzled. Yeah, okay. Well, the second part was going to be about how we don't understand anything. So, we can write down these effective theories of the inflaton field and its perturbations all we want, but we don't really understand what happened before and how to describe if this makes sense, the probability for any particular initial condition. It's worse than a situation, it's worse than other places in physics where we have big challenges where at least we know the Hamiltonian may be strongly coupled and we want to solve it, but at least we know the framework and we can at least set up the problem. Here it's worse than that. We don't really have a complete framework. We have accelerated expansion which draws observers outside each other's causal patch, and as a result, we don't really understand what probabilities mean in the full global picture of cosmology. So many of us work on this, and my own view is that we'll build up to a better understanding of this through better tools, including string theory, constructions of time-dependent backgrounds, generalizing the famous ADS-CFT correspondence. And just to close, one thing that some of us are quite excited about now is solutions for de Sitter space and inflation in string theory that are much simpler than previous ones that we have found. And so that's one direction that's active in this field, but there's quite a lot else going on. But I won't have time to explain it here.
Yes. Could you say a little bit more about, so given that we've now measured this small value of FNL local, what's sort of the theoretical,
it's very consistent with zero. That one is the one that's gotten most improved in its constraint.
Right.
So we've measured a non-zero value.
So, but observationally, there is still some hope to get a better measurement. And will that strongly inform the models?
Well, I would say opportunity for improvement is more in the other shapes, which I mentioned, which are the ones which have to do with single fields self-interacting. And the issue with answering your question, and let me draw one distinction. So that's, I think most people in this field view that as a very interesting direction. It doesn't have quite the sharp threshold that we have, say, for the B modes. For the B modes, we can aim for a Planck range in field space. It's a beautiful threshold that the experiments should cross. And, you know, to me, the either a detection or a null result at that level is very informative. It's kind of like with the LHC going through the TEV scale. Even if supersymmetry is ruled out, it's very informative. With non-Gaussianity, it's harder to put your finger on where to stop. I mean, you can get down to the intrinsic nonlinearities that we know about in gravity coupled to the scalar field. There's also this nice f pi scale that the effective field theory people have identified. But it's not that there's a complete mechanism or model of that we want to aim for particularly.
So one should basically do as well as one can with non-local models, but there's no clear...
With non-local...
With constraining non-Gaussian.
All these models involve local physics. The FNL local just means that the perturbation can be written function of x. Yeah. But other people should comment on that question. It's come up a lot. My view is very simple-minded, just go as far as we can go. And a sound speed of 0.01, which, in the mechanisms I know about, that's not a very big constraint yet. Yeah.
Where is the Planck suppressed coming
from? I'm sorry, I didn't come back to that. So I tried to explain how the whole subject is sensitive to Planck suppressed operators with couplings, higher dimension operators with a denominator of order of the Planck scale. And then really the Planck suppressed came from what Reese actually just asked about. So with FNL local, which was, I don't know, whatever it was, 5 or something, the point was one could couple inflation. So let me just write something down here that I had before. So you could ask, how much have we learned about the possibility of these hidden sectors through this constraint? And I quickly mentioned that this suppression scale M star, in fact, is constrained in a nice way to be several orders of magnitude above Hubble. And if we're talking high scale inflation, gut scale inflation, the sort of original idea, when people looked at this carefully, they found that this, in fact, could be the Planck scale. So the Planck satellite suppressed this Planck suppressed operator. OK. That's all I meant.
You do like your puns.
Look, they put it in the paper. That's all I can. Yes. Yes.
So you mentioned string theory only parenthetically here. What do you think are the prospects for seeing signatures of string theory?
Okay, so I think this B mode measurement is crucially important and incredibly interesting for that question because of the UV sensitivity that I went over, and it's true, I tried to be general about that. This case, which will, whether it's this case or the small field case, should be determined by these experiments. If it's the large field case, the natural mechanisms that we know about to accomplish that from the field theory or string theory point of view involve symmetries, so approximate shift symmetries of the inflaton field. This goes back to the M squared phi squared model, which is perfectly radiatively stable. But axion fields, which have a certain underlying, at least discrete, shift symmetry, and which are, half the fields in string theory, seem to me a very good place to look for this connection. And so another thing people are doing with this, so of course this is still just two numbers. Even if we're, fortunate enough to have the measurements come in consistent with these, you can't turn that around and say string theory was right. But there is a there is an opportunity for something closer to a smoking gun signature involving these oscillations. And one thing that people are discussing is how to do that. So there's been very interesting work on it so far. But people are discussing how to do that in a careful enough way to be faithful to the theory and not miss the effect if it's there or the constraint. Unfortunately, it's model dependent because this coefficient could be anything. This is the part that's the familiar field theory, you know, QCD like sinusoidal potential part. And you know, this amplitude is model dependent, whereas it's falsifiable on the basis of the D mode. But still, it's something nice to look for. And the interesting thing about it is, so just like the other fields adjust and make the potential a bit flatter as you go out, so that's getting this part right. Similarly, for reasons I could explain, the period adjusts a bit. So you know, as you look for this over, you know, 100 cycles, if you make a 1% error, you've lost it. Okay, so it's a very interesting challenge for this connection, but it's something people are working on. You know, again, even if this mechanism is correct, this signature isn't necessary, but it's a possibility. And I think, you know, I think, so I'm going to quote Matthias out of context. He said if they measure B-modes, he'll read a book on string theory. Actually, he said he'll either read the book on string theory or a book on planets. Well, Phil?
The current limit on M for n squared to pi squared theories is, yes, just, you know, too similar. But
yes.
How much flexibility is there to modify theories so that it's, I suppose it was 5 sigma or 10 sigma, is there a way out of that for that class of theory?
Well, I mean, you know, so just as an analog of that question, phi to the fourth, so this is the line of phi to the p, phi to the fourth is way excluded. I said way excluded. It's a technical term. Sorry. So you could ask that now. Is there? Could you maybe ask your question in this context? Are you saying is there some way to avoid that conclusion, or
is there any flexibility in twiddling the knobs on the theory to have the theory consist with m squared phi squared, but still not violate the constraints or even stronger constraints?
Well, so at the level of field theory, without taking into account the extreme UV sensitivity, you could imagine writing down any potential you want and just moving yourself around here. That's not satisfying to most of us, at least up here in this large field region, because of the sensitivity. So we expect that the structural constraints of the UV completion probably matter, or could at least matter, and so. So I could try and answer your question in the context of string theory as a candidate for that, where we, you know, given this mechanism, we can't, well, I think the short answer is we can't move things around, say, down from up here to down here in any, you know, simple continuous way. There are string theory mechanisms that lie in various different parts of this plot separately, but they're not closely connected in some way that you can just move a parameter around. I mean, this is closer to something like that where you can change it easily. Let me just go back. This is a specific model, and it's specific enough, it has a single parameter, it can be rolled out. It can just be rolled out. And, you know, that's great. Or if, you know, the data fluctuates back up here, it suggests it would then be a precision constraint to be used even to exclude heavy fields coupled to the inflaton. So just like we had with the local non-Gaussianity, which could be used to exclude couplings to light fields, you know, if we got close enough to this, we could exclude even couplings to heavy fields that would adjust. So I don't know if that helps, but.
Well, let's thank you again.